returned to Judea. We took a look at why. We took a look at how. We took a look at who. And I think I briefly addressed the question of when, that it followed upon the decree of Cyrus, which was given in 538, and so presumably almost immediately the return took place. And I think I drew your attention to the fact that though many detractors of this work tried to assert that the captives who were taken away by the Assyrians from the northern kingdom of Israel returned with the Jews and therefore healed the breach between the two peoples, and although they're all called Jews from this point on, you've got everybody practically back in the land, but that is not something that is the case. That they take off, of course, on this idea from the last verse of chapter 2 of Ezra, verse 70, which says, "So the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and the porters and the Nethinims dwelt in their cities and all Israel in their cities." But therefore we have a total return. Now granted, there were some northerners that had in several occasions, as we noted last semester, been added to the population in the south. And of course these would have been affected by the deportations by the Babylonians. But this is not the meaning of the phrase "all Israel," which is evident from two things. One, the listing itself, the cities to which they returned to are all firmly located in Judah, except for a few cities that are just across the old border and the old kingdom of Israel. And second, of course, we took note of the fact that in Ezra chapter 1, verse 5, the people that organized the return are identified as the chief of the fathers, in other words, the princes of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, and the leaders among the priests and the Levites. You don't find mention of the tribal leaders from the northern tribes. And so we essentially have a Judean return. We don't have a total Israelite return. There's another item which is used by detractors in support of their views, which we'll come to later in its proper context. We talked also about the possible relationship of Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel. And it's interesting that in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, where we have those boring genealogical lists. I put the word boring in quotes, though most of us tend to approach them in that fashion. Then we have the genealogy of David, the royal line. We have something that's very, very interesting because we come in chapter 3, 1 Chronicles 3 and verse 16, to Jehoiakim and then Jeconiah, his son. And then we have, of course, in verse 17, the sons of Jeconiah, Asir, Salatiel, Malchiram, and Pedaiah, and Shenazar. You'll notice that if we look at this and make sort of a genealogical chart, that what we have is Jeconiah as the progenitor, and then we have a number of sons who are mentioned as being his offspring, Asir, Salatiel, sons of Jeconiah, Asir, Salatiah, his son, which would be the son of Asir. Then you have Malchiram, and then Pedaiah. then we have Shenazar. We don't have to carry that any further to illustrate what it is I'm going to get at. And that is that when we find Zerubbabel mentioned, notice that it says in verse 19, the sons of Pedaiah were Zerubbabel and Shimei. The sons of Pedaiah were Zerubbabel and Shimei. We'll only put in Zerubbabel as being important. Now, what is interesting about this genealogical information? Anything that you're aware of? Nothing strikes you. Okay. If we look in the book of Ezra, how is Zerubbabel described? Chapter 5, verse 2. Alan? Yeah. Is that in Ezra chapter 5, verse 2, Zerubbabel is called the son of, and I'm spelling it the way we have it in our King James, Shealtiel. There's a variation on this, but in this particular genealogical information from First Chronicles, he is listed as the son of Pedaiah. What do we make of that? Yeah, that we may have a levirate marriage situation. That's the way it is commonly understood by scholars, is we've got, first of all, there's no major distinction between these two names. That throughout the Old Testament, you frequently have variations on the spellings of the names, sometimes even in the same chapter. For example, in the case of Jonathan, and you wouldn't notice this in the English, because the word Jonathan comes from the Hebrew, of course. But in one chapter, he is called Jehonatan, and in the same chapter, he's called Yonatan. You see, variations on that spelling. You also have, very commonly, in the case of Joram, you have the son of Ahab is sometimes called Joram with spelled this way, and sometimes its name is just spelled that way. J-O-R-A-M. They leave out the E-H, you see. Same thing is true of this particular king in Judah, who has his name spelled this way and this way. But we frequently have these variations on spelling. The same thing would probably be true of this Shenazar, who is expected to be Sheshbazar. You know, there's an identification made between these two names, that this is the identity of this mysterious Sheshbazar, who is mentioned in Ezra chapter 1. That Sheshbazar is the, of Ezra chapter 1, is to be identified with the Shenazar of 1 Chronicles 3. That would mean that Shenazar or Sheshbazar was an uncle of Zerubbabel. And that given a levirate marriage situation, that in one case we are giving the actual descent, you might say, and the other case we're giving the legal descent based on a levirate marriage situation. This is the way these things are usually approached. I wanted you to be aware of this. So at least you know that this is something that is there in the text, and what is the common way of resolving this particular difference of mention in terms of parentage. Yes. Well, it is possible that they had either predeceased or were otherwise ineligible to participate or declined to do so. Remember, the next of kin can decline. You see?
Mm-hmm. But would Pedaya's wife, I don't understand the situation.
Well, it can be a situation that Pedaya died leaving no issue, and therefore Salatiel is the one who raised up seed for her, or it could be the reverse situation. It's more likely to have been the case of Pedaya having died without issue, because he's apparently the older, unless there was an enormous age difference between Aser and Pedaya, and therefore Salatiel and Pedaya could have been very close in age. Depends on how much an age spread we have, we don't know. Yeah.
Would the wife of Pedaya have been an aunt of Salatiel?
No, because elaborate marriage, you know, obviously involves this kind of relationship. The usual view is that it's Pedaya who died without issue, because the chronology in Chronicles is showing legal relationships. And so even if Salatiel was literally his father, legally he would have been viewed as a son of Pedaya and not legally the son of Salatiel. And that the more in Ezra you're dealing with more a realistic description of what his ancestry is, it would appear, and therefore it's showing his literal father. Anyway, this is the general opinion as to how this probably obtained. Okay, I wanted to touch upon that matter since I had introduced it earlier. Okay, let's take a look now at some of the problems and situations that they faced upon their return. And number one, of course, is that we need to understand where they are located. There is a phrase which is used frequently in the book of Ezra, and it's used in one of two ways. This side of the river, and the other phrase is across the river, or the other side of the river. These are variations of the same phrase. And what river, of course, is being referred to? Dan? Great. Mm-hmm. Now, when we find this translated in the text, and to give you one such location, Ezra chapter 7, I'm sorry, not across the river, beyond the river is the way it is in my King James. Thinking of another. Beyond the river. This we have Ezra chapter 7 and verse 25. It says, "You, Ezra, after the wisdom of your God that is in your hand, set magistrates and judges which may judge all the people that are beyond the river." This phrase, beyond the river, should never have been translated into English, because it's a descriptor, it's a name of a province in the Persian Empire. And the term in the Hebrew is, or Aramaic, I should say, is Avar Nachar. This is the Aramaic phrase which is translated as beyond the river. And it's literally just the name of the province in the Persian Empire. This province had a number of subdivisions or sub-provinces, of which Phoenicia was one. Ammon was another. Samaria was another. And Judea, or as it was called then in the Persian period, Yahud, was the technical term, was just another subdivision of this larger administrative unit in the Persian Empire. The technical term that was used to describe this larger unit was satrapy. You will find it mentioned frequently in the texts. dealing with the history of this period. It was called a satrapy, and the governor over this large district was called a satrap. Then under the satrap, you would have individual pashas who ruled one of the specific subunits. And then the technical text in the Aramaic, this is the term which is used to describe people, for example, like later Nehemiah, they're described as Pasha of Judea, the governor of a subunit of the satrap. So this is something we need to understand, the overall administration, because this comes into the story in a number of different places. Now, the problems that they faced, of course, is, first of all, they came back to utter desolation. They had the tremendous burden of the labor of physical restoration of the land. This is something that was a major problem for them. The second thing that we read about, of course, is the problem of rebuilding the temple, which was part of their charge and commandment by King Cyrus, and of course a focal point of their own desires. Let us notice this in Ezra chapter 3, how they made a beginning upon their return. It says, when the seventh month was come, the children of Israel were in their cities. The people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Then stood up Yeshua. And Yeshua is, you notice there's a marginal reference, if you have marginal references, it says Joshua. Yeshua is simply the Aramaic form of the Hebrew name Joshua. In the same sense that Jesus is simply, comes from what language? Greek, which is simply a Greek version of the Aramaic Yeshua, or Yeshua, which is then from the Hebrew Joshua. So if you want to know what was Jesus' name in Hebrew, it would have been Joshua, which means what? Savior. And the same, that's why, you know, the name is exactly equivalent in meaning as well as very close in transliteration. Then stood up Yeshua, the son of Uzadak. And again, this indicates something about the nature of the people of this time, is that Aramaic had come to become their common language. And that many, of course, like Yeshua, who is now the high priest, has taken on an Aramaic name, to the point also that most people no longer can understand Hebrew. Remember, they've been living in Babylon for 70 years. And the common everyday language of business and politics in this period of time in which they were living in Babylon was Aramaic. And so therefore they naturally learned the language of their new homeland. In the same way, they also gave names to their children that were more in Aramaic than in Hebrew. Then stood up Yeshua the son of Uzadak and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and his brethren, and builded the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, and as is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Now, obviously, this was a first place for a beginning because they were anxious to resume the sacrificial system even before they had a full temple completed. They set the altar upon his basis, for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries. Now, why do you think they were in fear of the people of the countries that surrounded Judea? Why do you think there was a sense of fear here? Why not? Don't you think it might have built up the local economy to have more people coming in and everybody would have prospered? Why would the surrounding peoples have been nervous about this group of Jews coming back? Okay. Okay, the king was behind this move, and so this was something that, of course, was very displeasing to them. But as you said, Roger, very correct, they were worried that it would lead, as more Jews came back, if these people prospered in their return, they would attract more of them from Babylon, and they would need to expand. And, of course, where would they expand to? Into the areas that they were living in, you see. And so they were very upset about this. And so there was a considerable fear of these returnees from the surrounding peoples because of their hostility. And they offered burnt offerings thereon to the Eternal, even burnt offerings morning and evening. I think I should make a comment about this term morning and evening, because the term evening is a very bad translation, because of the way we use the word evening. What part of the day do we usually think of as evening? Johan, why do you pick six? But usually what condition of the sky obtains about that time is what I'm getting at. Jeff? Yeah, dusk. It's after sunset, the period of dusk before maybe complete dark, which we'd call night. And that's the way we use the term, but that's not what was meant in the text. Evening in the text means late afternoon, prior to sunset. And so what the sacrificial system had, there were two sacrifices offered on any particular day. There was a morning sacrifice, and there was a late afternoon sacrifice. There was no sacrifice that was made after night. In fact, even in the days of Jesus, we have a lot of detail from that period of time, the temple gates were closed at sunset. No services took place after dark. You see, this is not a... That's why it's an unfortunate translation that we've got an evening, the use of the term evening. Because when does the day begin? No, according to the way God counts time. Sunset. If then this was a sacrifice literally given in the evening, it would have been the first sacrifice on a given day. We should read evening and morning sacrifices. That makes a set for the day. You see, that's why we don't read evening and morning. We read morning and evening because that's the set for the day. It really is morning and afternoon, late afternoon. Okay. These were the two sacrifices, of course, that were defined by God in the legislation that was given, as it says, written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And if you have a marginal reference, you probably have, you know, some... There are many such references in the Torah. One is probably given. They kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the custom, as the duty of every day required. So their return, you notice back here in verse 1 of chapter 3, was in the seventh month. And so naturally the first feast they could keep in the seventh month, once they got things going again, of course, was the Feast of Tabernacles. And it obviously must have been something they enjoyed doing, because after having tried to keep the feast in a foreign land, they were now able to keep it fully. What were they prohibited from doing as long as they had been in Babylon that took away from the solemnity of observing the feast days? What was omitted by them? Barat? No, they weren't slaves. The vast majority weren't slaves, anyway. They were forcibly resettled, but that's the degree of their servitude. But there was something else that took away from that solemnity. Huh? Yeah, of course they weren't able to do that. And what else weren't they able to do? Flavian? Yeah, they had not sacrificed for 70 years. Because the only place they were allowed to sacrifice was in Jerusalem. Therefore, for 70 years of their living in Babylon and the associated area, they may have noted the days, but they couldn't do the essential ritual for that day, which was to offer the special sacrifices. And so this must have been a very exciting thing for them, that they were now able to get back into the full observance of what had been commanded. Afterward, they offered the continual burnt offering, both of the new moon and of all the set feasts of the Eternal that were consecrated, of every one that willingly offered a freewill offering unto the Eternal. Which shows us also where they got the animals for these sacrifices. You might want to make a little bit of a note mentally in your brain somewhere that this was the pattern they followed at this time, because in the time of Jesus, this was a big matter of dispute between the Sadducees and the Pharisees as to where should the animals come from that were used in the offerings. But in this particular point in time, anyone who chose and wanted to could donate the animal, and that would be the one that would be used. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer the burnt offerings unto the Eternal. So obviously they began their observances with the festival day of, we call Trumpets, you see. But the foundation of the temple of the Eternal was not yet laid. They gave money also to the masons, to the carpenters, meat, drink, and oil unto them of Zidon, to them of Tyre, to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the sea of Joppa, according to the grant that they had of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, in other words, they wanted to at least use the same kinds of materials as much as possible has been used in Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple, of course, had used cedars of Lebanon. I meant to bring a slide today, which is interesting, but I think I'll bring it in connection with another scripture, which shows something about the construction techniques of those days. Now, in the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity to Jerusalem. And they appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Eternal. In other words, the building was going to be supervised, of course, by the Levites. It was going to be their special province. But notice here in verse 8, backing up just a bit, we've got a dual leadership. We've got Zerubbabel, who is of the royal line and is sort of serving as the pasha or governor of Judea, and Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, who is the high priest. So we've got a civil and religious leadership working in tandem. This is the pattern that we find in the beginning of the Persian period, that we're going to see that that's going to change before long. Okay, we can skip over the actual details of the foundation of this temple, and then we can see what happened here in verse 11. They sang together by course, the Levites, of course, the singers, praising and giving thanks to the Eternal, because he is good, for his mercy endures forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Eternal, because the foundation of the house of the Eternal was laid. You can imagine the tremendous enthusiasm that was generated by actually seeing the work beginning. But many of the priests and Levites and the chief of the fathers, who were ancient men, that had seen the first house, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice. Well, of course, many were shouting aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of the joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. Now, why were they weeping? What possible reasons might have been involved in these older people weeping? Ken? Well, not Solomon, to the time of... Okay. They weren't quite that old. But, you know, we have... You know, do you know who the oldest student is in the college? No. We have a real Ancient of Days as a student in the college, at least according to the little pictorial. The person was born in 640 A.D. You can go through it and look. One of those typos. But that's her birth year. So she is truly the oldest student on campus. So anyway, these were people that had seen the previous temple, but why were they weeping? You weep sometimes for different reasons. You can weep because of sadness, you can weep because of joy. You know, the tears of joy can come down your cheeks too sometimes. Especially when people are reunited after many years. Sometimes they're both weeping. They're not crying because they're sad. They're crying because they're so happy. You know, they're overcome, so they cry. Which one do you think this was? Well, let's just see. How many of you think they were weeping because they were so happy? Overcome by emotion. How many of you think because they were so sad? Interesting. Didn't usually have this kind of division in the past. Usually it was the other way around. Well, it could be either one. You really don't know from the text. You're free to make your own choice. It has been alleged that the foundation of this was such a miserable substitute for what the glory that had been before, that they wept in sadness for the glory that would not be restored. And others have alleged that they wept in joy that which they had enjoyed in the temple was now about to rise again. They were so pleased that they had lived to see this day. They thanked God for preserving their life to this day so they could see this joyful occasion. And it supposedly goes back to this particular incident. They were so pleased that they had survived long enough that before their eyes closed, they could see God's temple started again. So we can take our choice. I sometimes lean more in favor of joy because if only the foundation had been laid, how could they tell that it would be so poor a substitute for what had been before? Unless they just assume that's what would be the case. So I tend to lean more in the direction of weeping for joy to see the thing starting to be rebuilt. Now we find in verse 4 more details of the opposition. When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin, again, interesting, if this is all the tribes of Israel, why is it that they're described this way? You know, because if all of them were present in their large numbers, or at least representatively, Judah and Benjamin would not have been singled out this way. When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity built the temple unto the eternal God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers, and they said to them, "Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we do sacrifice to him since the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Asshur, which brought us up into this region." Now, which particular people are pronouncing the statement? Just this little bit of detail tells us who they are, besides just adversaries. Arthur? If they identify themselves as people that worship the same God, and they have been doing that ever since the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here, what do we call the people that were brought into this area by the kings of Assyria? Samaritans. They were settled in the cities of Samaria instead of the northern tribes who were deported. So these Samaritans are singled out among the adversaries as coming up to Zerubbabel and saying, "Let us join with you in this great enterprise. Let us have a part in building this temple, because after all, we worship the same God and we sacrifice to him just as you do, and we've been doing it ever since we were planted in this land." And what is it that Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the others say? "You have nothing to do with us to build the house to our God. We ourselves will build it to the eternal, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." What kind of an answer? How would you characterize the answer? Can we put it in vernacular, colloquial expression? Would you like to offer a shorter summary of this message? And the current vernacular of our day, Mr. Fraser? Right. You're dated, I'm afraid. What is something even more? No, you're right. I would have said get lost too, but what's another one that maybe is more common? Huh?
No way, Jose.
No way, Jose. Bug off or buzz out or whatever, and variations thereof. Obviously, this is not a very soft answer designed to turn away wrath. This is a very imperative, declining of their favored, offered assistance. Why? The Bible doesn't stop to explain why this harsh answer. Can we surmise some reasons? Because that's all we can do, of course, is maybe come up with some suggestions that probably would hold water. Mr. Roybal? Well, all the money, of course, is going into the temple. So there's not a chance they would get a share of the money. Yeah, well, you mean employment, you mean, perhaps. Maybe that's possible. I had never thought of that before. There might be some small possibility of that. But I think there's some other major reasons that we could surmise that probably would carry more weight. Edith? right. You see, you have to understand the mentality of these returnees. They had been planted in this land by God. This was their inheritance. And they had mucked up their relationship with God. And as punishment, they'd been sent into exile. And now, God was giving them a second chance to do it right. Would the right thing be, right at the start of the second chance, to invite in these half-pagan, half-Israelitish worshippers from the north to participate in building the temple? Obviously, that's not the way that you want to start off. Because that had been Judah's problem. It was a mixing of paganism with the worship of Yahweh, which had so irritated God, he finally cast them out. So that's not the way you start off, is by mixing in paganism with the proper worship of God. So they very forthrightly and steadfastly said, you know, we don't want any part of your mixing in with this. Now, why do you think the Samaritans had offered it in the first place? Do you think they really were that zealous in worshiping the God of Israel and said, oh boy, a new superior temple to the one we've got is going up. Let's, you know, show our loyalty to it and come down and do this. What else might have been working here? Wendy? Mm-hmm. And why? If this temple succeeded in being built, what was the most likely outcome that could represent a threat to the Samaritans? Neil? Yeah, what justification could the Judeans use for taking over the land that the Samaritans were occupying? Can you think of a logical thing they might have advanced? Stephen? Yeah, exactly. Right, and even if they weren't literally the descendants of the northern tribes who had lived there, they at least ethnically were closer to them than the Samaritans and had a better claim to it since they were of the seed of Israel. You see, the people that God had given the land to in the first place. And so we can probably surmise that the Samaritans were nervous about that, and they were trying to get in on the ground floor, so to speak, either to obligate the Jews so they wouldn't dispossess them later, or maybe, as it's been alleged by some, to frustrate the work from within, to try to make it not succeed. Because obviously the temple God built, it would be sort of like a beacon drawing more Jews there. And therefore, that's not something that they would particularly have been happy about. So then we find that as a result of being told to, you know, that they weren't wanted, the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah, and they troubled them in building. They not only directly troubled them, but they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, even to the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. So in other words, the work really did not go anywhere all the rest of the days of Cyrus and all the intervening kings until, of course, the time of the Darius, the king of Persia. Now, what is interesting here is we need to consider the genealogical listing of Persian kings, because this represents an interesting situation, the rest of this chapter. Cyrus, 539-530, as far as his rule over Babylon. He was succeeded by his son Cambyses in 530, who ruled to 522. He was succeeded shortly by, well, I guess I should call him Pseudo-Smerdis. What does pseudo mean? False. It is generally accepted that Smerdis, who was a brother of Cambyses, had been murdered or executed while Cambyses still lived. But somebody came up and claimed to be Smerdis and the heir to the throne. And from about 522, there was a lot of confusion. Then we have Darius the First, who technically begins reigning in 522, but the same time as Sudhasmritis, but really doesn't come into full control until about 519, when he's fully in control of the empire. And he rules until 486. Then we have Xerxes, who rules from 486 to 465. Then Artaxerxes, the first, from 465 to 423. And then we have Darius the second, who rules from 423 to 405. Now, given this genealogical information, work your way through the rest of this chapter and tell me why something doesn't add up. Okay. I might say that Ahasuerus is usually thought of as being Xerxes. Ahasuerus, who is mentioned in verse 6, is usually identified with the Xerxes in the Persian king list. So in verse 5, they hired counselors to frustrate them all the days of Cyrus, even until the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. And then the next verse talks about Xerxes. And then you start talking about a letter that was written in the days of Artaxerxes. Of information that you may not all remember is, in what year was the temple finished? 515. Hey, Jeff? You all see that? So what do we do? Move the date of the temple? What's the answer, Wes? A second temple. You mean they finished in 515 and then somehow it was destroyed and they started over again? Because tradition says nothing about that. This temple continued all the way down to the days of Herod when he rebuilt it. No. That unfortunately won't suit, Robert. Yeah. That's what we've got. We don't have it in chronological order. We've got to rearrange these verses, put them in proper chronological order. You see, the subject of verse 4 is not just the temple. What is the subject primarily of verse 4? No, verse 4. You're in verse 5. Alan? Yeah. And they continue to cause problems, as it says in verse 5, all the days of Cyrus, even to the days of Darius, meaning Darius the first. Then it's got into this subject of problems caused by their neighbors. And it continues to talk about other problems that their neighbors are causing in the days of Xerxes and even in the days of Artaxerxes. Then when the author exhausted that train of thought, he backs up to the matter of the temple, you see, in verse 24. Now, another clue to this is the letter itself. Summarize what these people are saying in the letter. What are they asking the Persian king to stop? And this is where people don't read carefully. They assume one thing when the letter says something else. Ross. Russ. Which is it?
Yeah.
not just the city, but also the wall. It has nothing to do with the building of the temple, whoever. And obviously it wouldn't. If the letter was written in the reign of Artaxerxes, somewhere between 465 and 423, the temple was already built. That's a non-issue. What sense does it say to write to him and say, stop the building of this temple, when it's already standing there, fully built? You see, that doesn't make any sense. But, I mean, if you look at the letter and read it carefully, what they're saying to the king is, don't let these people build the wall around the city. Because once you've got a wall around a city, you can defend it, right? And they're saying, if you let them get in a position where they could defend their city, they're going to do what they've always done, become contemptuous of authority, reject your rulership, they're not going to pay you your taxes, they're not going to pay you your tribute, they're going to stick their thumb their noses at you, and you're going to have to come back and punish them. Look, if you don't believe us, go check the records and find out the history of this city. That they used to be really bigwigs in this area, they used to rule this whole area, and they just have a history of being rebellious. So we're just trying to be the friends of the king, you see, and let you, prevent you from getting hurt from this. And so what does Artaxerxes write back? He says, yeah, you're right. The letter was read to me, and I did check, and yeah, this city has a reputation of being seditious. You're right. And so, therefore, I have ruled that you are commanded to force them to stop until I should decide in the future that they may have a wall. You know, he leaves himself an out, you see. And until I decide otherwise, they must stop. And then, of course, we see verse 23, when the copy of the king letter was read to them, they went up in haste to Jerusalem and made them cease. Cease what? The work on the wall. You see, that's what was the subject of the letter. And by force and power, they made them stop building the wall. And then, of course, we jump back in time to the previous subject matter, which had to do specifically with the temple. But as I said, what is necessary is to read carefully the text of the letter, you see, and see that it doesn't make any reference whatsoever to the temple. And then, of course, to consider the chronological implications, which, of course, helps us to understand it properly. Okay, why is this letter set in here in this particular place? As I say, simply because the writer was working on a theme of antagonisms and how they were being hindered by their neighbors, and just followed it down in time to this most serious problem they had in the days of Artaxerxes. And then when he had exhausted that particular topic, he got back to his original point, which was the temple itself. And say, we wouldn't necessarily write this way, but they did. And as I said, in the first semester class, we saw other examples of this type of digressions, and then you have to come back to the point of departure. Okay, we will take a look at the chronology of this next time, the chronological reconstruction, therefore, of this period of time from 539 to 515, and get into also, I'd like you to get ready for Ezra, the spiritual reconstruction of Judea, too. Oh, no, we won't be able to cover that, no. We'll just do the chronological reconstruction next time. So do all the reading assignment for January 29.